Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 59, titled Anger Management for Women.
About anger is that it's a big problem for women. And males are indoctrinated, socialized to express their anger more readily and be more domineering. And if you had brothers, maybe father, colleagues at school, males will interrupt their conversations. Males will be like that. And women are socialized to be more patient and accepting, which actually is a virtue. And I think it's so brilliant what Isa said about that aggressiveness about the males. It's a weakness, actually. So unfortunately, too many people tell the women, oh, you're supposed to get angry. And that's the way you find your equality, is through anger. And so I want to just talk about that in it for a moment, because it's so important. And the key essence of it, I'm going to read you just a few verses from Shantideva and comment on them, and recommend that book, of course, to everyone. I saw Jasdeep had a copy. She was running around with a copy earlier. And it's called Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life. Another translation is called The Way of the Bodhisattva. There's like four or five translations, because it is a great, great, great classic. Not only about anger and patience, but about all of the evolutionary practice of improving one's infinite life, seeing to it that one's infinite life goes in a positive direction. But his sixth chapter, which is the chapter on patience or tolerance, which is the antidote to anger or hatred, anger/hatred, is really an absolute classic. And of course, it's part of the what's called the special precept of love and compassion, of the equal exchange of self and other. That is the special gift of His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, to the planet. His whole thing about his religion is kindness, the common human religion is kindness, and all of that sort of stuff comes from this, in a way. It comes from Manjushri and Shantideva, and Nagarjuna and Shantideva. But these verses are wonderful. The key insight is, women should be more forceful, yes, from strength, from the knowledge internally of their deepest, deathless, reality-based strength, which is unshakable. Akshobhya, as they say in Sanskrit, cannot be, can never be lost. It will never, even they die, it will not disappear. They will always rest in it. They will bring forth new life for themselves and others, always. It's that kind of strength. And then from that, there should be the confidence to project more force. But that force should always be projected with the emotional energy of joy, the emotional energy of humor, that means, the emotional energy of happiness, never the emotional energy of anger and hatred, which is always based on weakness. And is an addiction. It's called a mental addiction, because it's deception. To us ignorant beings, is that it's making us strong when we feel weak. That's why it's addictive. When you get in a rage, a towering rage, you feel I'm strong. And that's why, and it seduces you into, therefore, becoming its tool. But since it is actually deceiving you in your distorted, wrong sense of weakness, it leads you into a worse situation. And it harms yourself and others. That's the key of the essence to it. But it's very subtle, the idea of separating force from anger and taking the force, your force, back from the addictive habit of anger. That's the key, totally key. And he begins, he says, whatever my virtuous deeds, devotion to Buddhas, generosity, and so on, amassed over 1,000 aeons, all are destroyed in a moment of fury. And talk about relationships. How many relationships have we had that were sort of okay? They were budding, there were ups and downs. it could have been really positive for a while, and then somehow something happened and one really lost it and was said all kinds of horrible things, did horrible things, maybe was violent, and lost the relationship completely. How many times has that happened to people? I think maybe you guys are nicer than me. Too many times. There is no sin as harmful as hate. Anger, hate. No penance as effective as tolerance. Thus, you know, no asceticism, no ascetical penance as effective as tolerance. Thus, by all possible means, I should cultivate tolerance with intensity, fierce tolerance I should develop. In other words, I should develop tolerance to such a degree that no matter what they do to me, it doesn't make me angry, doesn't make me hate them. It might make me be forceful with them or myself, preventing them or avoiding them or stopping them from doing more, whatever it might be, but never out of anger or hatred, which is possible. And the key to that is it's like if we understand that anger, hatred will make it a dash thing. But sometimes people want to make anger into a good thing, which it isn't, never is, actually. So anger, hatred, and you know that it isn't because when you feel it, you feel painful. It makes you feel painful, therefore it's not good. You know, the angry person feels very stressed. You know, the cortisol is flowing, very bad for the health and so forth. So, but then the addiction, the first step, cigarettes, you know, whatever it might be, is it's really no good and I don't want to do it anymore. And that's a very important step because addictive things, addictive habits are seductive. They're addictive because they deceive us into thinking they're helping us. Keeping the mind wounded by hate, by anger, hate, I will never experience peace. I will have no joy or happiness. I will lose sleep and rise with discontent. That's how it feels to be angry, right? Doesn't it? Even a lord whose magnanimity is vital to those he gives wealth and status to is nonetheless in danger of being killed if he has hatred for them. You know, if he does it with contempt and despising them, even though he's their source of livelihood, they'll rebel and they'll hate him back. So it's bad for you, in the previous verse, bad for your relationship. Hate, anger, hate wears out friends and relatives. Though attracted by your generosity, they will not trust you. In sum, there is no way to live happily together with the fire of rage. Anger, my only real enemy, hatred and anger, creates such sufferings as these. But who controls and conquers it finds happiness here and hereafter. So that first part is just developing the resolve to fashion for yourself the invulnerable shield of tolerance where nothing can hurt you, because even something that seems on the surface to hurt, you can use to your advantage by strengthening your tolerance. It's a very, very deep thing. It's the only way to be safe, actually. Hate, and this verse is really now key, moves into another thing of giving insight. Hate, anger, hate, finds its fuel in the mental discomfort I feel faced with the unwanted happening and the blocking of what I want to happen. It then explodes and overwhelms me. So this is the key. When something is happening we do not like, and we sort of grin and bear it, but we're very frustrated, and the frustration builds and builds and builds. Or it could be some good thing that we want to see happening is being blocked by some bad people we think who are bad, and we're frustrated and builds and builds and builds, and then it explodes. Because we feel weak, unable to affect the situation. We can't make the good thing happen. We can't prevent the bad thing from happening. We feel weak. Anger comes to us in our own voice and says, you know, you can't do anything about this. But if you blow up, you'll have the strength to do something about it. and then we blow. You follow? That's the mechanism. This will make you strong when you feel weak, precisely. That's very important to be aware of. Seeing that, I should carefully eliminate that food that gives life to the enemy. For that enemy has no activity at all other than causing me harm. And here the enemy is my own anger, hatred. It's not the person who's blocking the good thing I want to see happen, who's causing the bad thing I want to see. That's not the real enemy. It's temporarily an enemy. But the real enemy is my anger, hatred, that is going to make me... The enemy's probably doing it. The relative enemy, outside enemy, is probably doing it because they feel I'm in their way of their happiness. I'm blocking what they want to see happen. And they're just acting helplessly, the tool of their anger and hatred. So if I become angry and hatred, it has conquered me, and now I'm just also the tool of angry hatred, and we have the spiral of violence, the cycle, a vicious circle, vicious cycle. And this is key. Whatever happens, this is the sacred feminine that you can be and do. Whatever happens, I must not allow my cheerfulness to be disturbed. Being unhappy won't fulfill my wish and will lose me all my virtues. And here's the sort of kicker verse, which I never like how I translated it, but why be unhappy about something if it can be fixed? Why be unhappy about something if it can't be fixed? Basically, why be unhappy? And here is the key. When you feel frustrated because the world is not conforming to your wish, positive or negative, whichever it is, and then frustration, you then immediately you use your mindfulness to you recognize, this frustration will build up and I'm going to blow up if I let it go on. So then what you do is you intervene. And here's where the divine feminine's green tower force can come out. Just when you're beginning to feel frustrated, but you're still cheerful. So then you intervene. You tell that jerky guy who's talking trash. You know, I'll give an example. She doesn't like when I use her example. But she's not here, so I can say, for example, sometimes I'll come in our long life together. I will come back from a situation where I'm angry because somebody was really stupid and all this and that happened. I'm very frustrated, angry. I say, you know what happened? And I'm about to tell her. And she says, well, must have been awful. Why don't you shut up about it before we're both pissed off? And she says it in a cheerful way. And then because it's cheerful, at first, I want to get more. Well, you're not listening to me and sharing it. And then I realize, well, of course, we don't want to both be freaked out. And later, I can calmly say if it's something important. And I'm no longer freaked out. And it completely shoots in waves. Makes me want to, because it makes me want to restrain myself. Because you can't restrain another person who is like being mentally harmful. You know, like people who are liberals and who really want the best for the world, for example, the revolutionaries. This is what you said about resistance movements. I think we were talking somewhere. You're right. You know, you can be somewhere, things are happy, and then suddenly the professional protester, you know, like a little bit Ralph Nader, for example. Oh, they're all no good. And he goes, Rente and Raby, how horrible they are, or Chomsky or something like that. And then suddenly all the evildoers are right there in the room with you. And everybody's mad. And then, of course, nobody can think of what to do. Anything positive, see. So this is, joy is the key. Happiness is the key. Cheerfulness. I think the secret of the British Empire is a cup of tea. Seriously. Of course, they stole it from China. They were the Colombian drug dealers of the ancient world. They grew opium in India and smuggled it into China because the Chinese didn't want their weird goods and certainly didn't want their cooking. They didn't want anything much. I mean, they wanted the tea, you know. But then, anyway, they did that. And then they got their tea. And then when everybody was all, bombs were falling, they, let's have a cup of tea, right? Although, actually, the people who invented the cup of tea were Buddhist monks, actually, in China, in the western part of China, up on the borderlands of Tibet, where the best tea grew. And they use the tea to stay awake meditating, so they wouldn't pass out and fall asleep, which is why you do sit up meditating, Pam. You can meditate lying down, but there's a tendency to pass out. So this I just want to share. Because the woman in our culture doesn't play hockey, lacrosse, and football, usually, in the old days, is not socialized to be quick to being forceful. And the key to adjusting that balance is not to resist angrily, because then they will bring down more counteraction and violence upon themselves. And also they'll feel bad doing it and make it worse. But to use forcefulness and to break in, and use their intuition. You know, Alexandra brought up intuition very helpfully. You know, when you go on a date, when you meet somebody, you know in 3 minutes if they're an absolute moron, idiot, maybe a Republican, then you know that right away. But nowadays, the old days they were okay, but now they're all missed. And, but you know right away. And then, but what you socialize to do is bear with it. Okay, sure, keep talking trash, keep talking stupid things. Repeat Rush Limbaugh's latest sermon to you. Go ahead. And then you get more and more irritated. Finally, they say something that crosses the line, you blow up. Has it ever happened to any of you? I think so. So the key there is, snap, do that intuition. Well, I knew that person was going to turn out to be an idiot. Well, then go right away in there with humor. Hey, man, that's so stupid. Do you enjoy being stupid? Or is it just for fun? Or whatever, what can we do about it? Can we learn something? How about a fact, Whatever. And then they'll either leave, which is good. Actually, my eldest son, who is much smarter than me, he has a motto for Nina. His motto about me. It's also very good. I'll just tell you. So his mother is always a little critical of his parents. And he says, that's all I want to read. And he says, my motto is, because he gets it from my carpentry, because I built at my own house. And I'm a carpenter. He says, my dad's motto is, why do it right when you can do it yourself? And his motto about Nina is, why be nice to them for a while only to have them get mad at you later when you can piss them off right away? But it's actually, she gets, oh, I don't want to, but it's very, she's a little proud of it too, but it's very important for women in our society. And actually, if you're really joyful and you're so skillful and you have great good humor and beauty, and so you can get in there to the Donald Trump type before they rant, as they just start to rant and rave, and you can kind of tweak it in another direction by intervening and resisting, but in a humorous way, but critical, but standing up for yourself and saying, I'm not going to tolerate this thing that's going to lead to me being frustrated and then being angry, and either expressing the anger in an angry way and getting more angry from this abuse, this stupidity, or not expressing it ever and then internalizing it and feeling all depressed. Either way, it isn't the anger. If you express anger, it doesn't make you feel better, actually. But if you are forceful, happily, you feel better. The key is you never need to start not feeling better. That's the most important point in Shanti Deva's teaching. And it takes mindfulness. The purpose of mindfulness, that thing about everybody does vipassana, and but they don't really usually get to the real level of vipassana, which is where you're looking for the self and failing to find it. That's what vipassana really is aiming at. But the first level of it, which is the mindfulness level, is where you count that breath, and then your mind wanders off into memory or fantasy or expectation or worry. Trains of thought takes it away from counting your breath. And you suddenly go, oh, back to breath. And then you feel bad, your mind wanders, and all this kind of thing. But what the point of that is to dismount from the thought stream. To begin to realize that you have a choice internally. Where's that lovely lady who talked about choice? Oh, she left this morning. She's not here.
It was Nancy.
What?
It was Nancy.
Nancy, that's right. Oh, too bad. Anyway, you have an inner choice. When you have a thought stream about whatever, you have a choice to follow it or not follow it. You can replace it with a different thought stream. In other words, you develop kind of control. It's like, I like to say, it's like if you've never practiced any kind of mindfulness, which you might have come upon, of course, by nature, not just from Buddhism or something. It's not only by Buddhism. It's in all proverbs of all different cultures to be mindful about your reactivity and your thought and be victim of your own thoughts. But it's very specially and sophisticatedly worked out in the Buddhist psychological tradition. And what that means is that you become aware of the mechanisms of reaction. And you don't think because an inner voice of your own tells you something like, I hate that. I have to say something awful to that person, or I can't stand this, or, you know, this kind of thing. You can intervene in your mind and say, well, is it I really can't stand it? Is it necessary to do this? Is there another way of handling it? In other words, you have the freedom internal to choose between how you're going to, whether you're going to follow a reactive pattern or not. And for that, you need to get yourself a little space, split second. That's like taking 10 deep breaths before having a fight, type of thing. You know, that's without Buddhism. You have that. Everyone knows that. But it's a matter of learning to use it and getting more skillful about it. And then you can keep your good cheer, right? This is key. And I think it's key in sort of a practical level as the third takeaway of the sacred thing. Okay? So now, that's it. That's all I have.